Okay. I'll introduce the speaker. Our speaker, a brother from the fellowship, is one who's, I'll just speak for myself, I don't know about anybody else, no, but one who's shares and leads, I always look forward to very much. So here's Michael.
I've got all my supplies here, my water. If I break into flop sweat, I've got my napkins. I'm good. Thank you for letting me do this. This is like a great opportunity for me. I come to this group. I don't know if I'm going to be very linear tonight. I might jump around a little bit. This will be like Arrival. I don't know if you've seen Arrival yet, but it's all about time is not quite what we think it is. So it might be like that. Hi, my name is Mike. Yeah. My name is Mike. Last time I checked. And I lost my, that always makes me lose my place when I say my name. So I'll just start over again, but I'm glad to see you. Oh, I was just gonna say, the reason I came here, this 7 o'clock Let's Rock, I don't know if, how many of you are new, but this meeting's been here for a long time. I didn't come for the longest time because I had issues about La Cunada, but it's nothing, I mean, I have issues about everything. But I came here out of spite. My then boyfriend was busy with rehearsals at Pasadena City College Chamber Orchestra when I wanted to spend Thursday nights with him. So I thought, well, heck with you. I'll get busy on Thursday nights. So I came here completely for the wrong reasons. I didn't want help. I really didn't want help. I didn't want to be in a room full of men and wonder what they were thinking of me. I only came here out of spite. My message to you is that God will get you where you need to be no matter what, you know? So in my case, spite was just what I needed, and it brought me here. And I've been here, and I've been coming back. Every week, my poor, long-suffering sponsor knows, because we carpool together, every week, I'm griping about coming over here. We're in the car, you know, we're in the carpool lane, you know, it's like going, it's going good. We're in the carpool lane, life is beautiful. And it's like, oh, my job is so hard and I'm so stressed out and I don't have time to eat between coming home from work and going out to this meeting. I'm just an intolerable. And then I get here. And it's like, okay, cookies are good, and it's nice, I'll stay. You know, I have to stay because I'm carpooling. And I swear to God, it has never failed once that I go home the happiest person in the group, the most glad that I heard what I heard that night. This is a very powerful room with very beautiful people, you, who share the most incredible, honest, moving, eye-opening, challenging, loving stuff. So I just stand here really, I'm no expert on Al-Anon. I've been in 19 years and the more I'm here, the less I feel I know. But it's kind of a good thing in a way. Because it's a little bit about deconstructing the ego, I think, is finally happening. Please, please. And and the speaker nights, especially. Speaker nights when I moan the most. I'm keeping my language really clean tonight. That speaker night is when I say, oh my God, sit there for 40 minutes and listen. And then like we're done and we're over. And it's like, oh my God, did you hear what they said? That was so amazing. I never looked at it that way. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. I hope that you might hear something useful tonight, but if you don't, it's okay because I'm not your higher power. So you're going to be taken care of and I have nothing to do with it. Oh. 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 God, what a relief. Oh. You understand, right? You're Al-Anons. You know what I'm talking about. Gosh. I was going to the gym before I came here. I go to a special gym. I don't know if any of you are members. It's called 24 Hour Compare and Despair. I'll never. Why do I even bother? Why do I even bother? That's just one of the little ways I like to drive myself crazy. But I'm here. I was thinking, I woke up with a nightmare last night, and I didn't really get back to sleep, but I was thinking about doing this, and I thought, I'm a theater person. I was a theater major in college, which means I'm completely unemployable, and but I have a use here, so that's good. I like a playwright named Eugene O'Neill, who wrote an amazing play that really, really is about alcoholism. And I wanted to share a quote with you that just inspires me in all seriousness. And it's not conference approved, so I'm a little worried I might get carted off to Virginia Beach for saying it, but I'm gonna just forge ahead and hope for the best. If you're newcomers, Virginia Beach is where the World Service Office is located for Al-Anon. I don't wanna do any inside jokes that exclude people. So there's an alcoholic father in the play, and he's also a narcissist. He's an actor, all about him. And he has two sons. And this is the younger son is having this chat with him. And they're kind of bearing their souls to each other for the first time ever. The younger son's probably in his mid-20s by this point. And the narcissist father is telling all about his great experiences on the stage, you know. And then I played this role in this theater, and they all went crazy, and I played this role in this, you know, and he's doing his narcissistic drunkalogue, sort of. And the son says, well, let me tell you some of my experiences. And he says, they all have to do with the sea. And it's a long speech, I won't quote it all, because I don't even know it all. But he talks about these transcendent moments where he felt like he was one with something larger. And he says it was like a saint's vision of beatitude. It's like the veil of things as they seem is drawn back by an unseen hand. And you see. And seeing the secret, you are the secret. Then, this is the alcoholic part. Then the hand lets the veil fall, and you are alone, lost in the fog, stumbling on toward nowhere for no good reason. I didn't want to bring you all down, but that kind of encapsulates how I've experienced this disease, so I'll tell you a little bit about that. Al-Anon, by the way, has been what's lifted the veil for me, so I'm very grateful. Someone told me I shouldn't talk about anything prior to fourth grade, but I'm just going to do it anyway. I want you to know my experience about everything I know I learned before then. My experience around alcoholism is as a child born into a family where alcoholism was very rampant. And my father was a heavy-duty drinker. You know, I get older and I look back and I'm seeing him more as a person and not so much as a two-dimensional alcoholic figure. And I'm more mindful now that he spent some time in a prison camp in Burma in World War II and probably other things in his life that he never talked about. And I get him more and more as I get older, and I feel a little bad for the box that I kind of put him in, but I did the best I could. So his drinking was completely out of hand, and my mother was, I always think she was like the untreated Al-Anon, and in a way she was. She was always managing and making sure things happened and making sure we got to school and making sure, you know, all the business of being this little nuclear family happened. And always pointing the finger at my dad. You know, so there was no question. Sometimes people share, they say, well, there was alcoholism, but we didn't know it, or I didn't know it. We knew it. We knew it because my mom made sure we knew it, because she would tell us how what a horrible alcoholic our father was. I have a sister who's 3 years older than I, and she and I don't know if it's just biological or if it's the way we coped with the situation, but we took two very different routes. I was an apple polisher, big time, and school A's, E's, I think we had E's for deportment, excellent, and I loved school. First of all, it was structured, and so it was a relief to me to go to school. And I loved that you could, like, you turn in a paper, and then you get a grade. It was, like, logical. It made sense. Because in our home, nothing made sense. I always say that the drinking didn't bother me so much. The fighting bothered me. Bothered me a lot. And it was pretty constant. But I have to say, just to round it out, so I don't stereotype anybody, that we had fun too. And that my dad, for all his drinking, one of my favorite memories, he knew all the words to the Trouble song from The Music Man, which I'll do for you after the meeting if you like. Or maybe before if I run out of things to say. And it's beautiful song. It's a Patterson, it was the rap. It was the first rap song, I think, because it was a spoken song, spoken to rhythm. And it's a brilliant, funny song. And he would put me on his shoulders. I was about 18. No, I was a little kid, and he put me on his shoulders and go around the living room doing the Trouble song. And I remember holding his forehead. And I remember the sweat on his forehead. And I remember the smell. He had the smell of the alcohol. It came out of him all the time. And it was just his smell, and I remember that a lot. He was funny, and my mom was a scream. She had these weird little talents, and one of them she would do at parties. I don't know if this will make sense, but she did it. There's a song called By the Sea, By the Sea, By the Beautiful Sea. You know that song? By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea. So she would laugh the song. So she'd go, ha ha ha, ha ha ha, ha 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 ha. And she would laugh through the song, and she'd get to laughing, and it was hysterical. So you can't use too broad a brush when you look back on alcoholic memory lane. My sister, I was going to say, was older, and she, as good as devout an apple polisher as I was, she was the trouble child, always in trouble. When she got old enough, like teens, she was getting arrested, drugs, always acting out. We went to a little private school in Beverly Hills called Berkeley Hall School, I guess I can say that. And that was a school for Christian Scientists. Oops, I was just going to say a religious school. Sorry, now you know my deep secret. Anyway, we were not very observant in our named religion. In my religion, you weren't supposed to drink or smoke. Everybody drank and smoked in my family. Now, I was liking the structure of school, and I also liked the structure of my religion. I went to Sunday school, so I was really soaking up this philosophy, this view of the universe that was so appealing, and this idea that if you could get your thoughts right, you could heal anything. And I thought, that's it. I can overcome what I'm going through with my family, because I can think the right thoughts. I thought that for a long time, and nothing got better. Nothing got better. So I couldn't blame the thought system that I was thrown into. I didn't, and I couldn't blame my folks, because they were my caregivers, and if I blamed them, I'd feel like I was, you know, out of luck completely. So I blamed myself. I blamed myself. And I'm the one they talk about. I'm sure a lot of you are too, in the meeting where they say we thought we weren't good enough, attractive enough, or smart enough to solve this problem for the one we loved. And that's my story in a nutshell, really. I can tell my whole life story really in two or three sentences. I grew up with unhappy people. I tried to make them happy. I failed, and I blamed myself ever since. Not ever since, but for a long time. So my sister got kicked out of our Tony little private school because she wore a St. Christopher medal, and well, that's a long story, but you don't do that in a Christian Science school. And so there was a lot of shame, you know. Everyone knew that I was from this tainted family. Then when I was about 12 or 13, my dad came home drunk. Oh, by the way, he used to hide his bottles in the garage. You know, they sort of talk about counting bottles and finding liquor, stuff like that we do. I used to go out to the garage, and I'd look behind a rafter or in his toolkit, and there would be these bottles of Cutty Sark. That was his brand, Cutty Sark. And I was fascinated. I didn't understand a thing about alcoholism, but I just thought these bottles are powerful. This stuff is powerful, because this is where he spends his time, is in the garage with these bottles. So I would unscrew the top and sniff it and think, what is it about this? So I was just curious about that. One night he came home and announced that, we lived in West LA in a very small house, and his boss lived close by, but definitely other side of the tracks in Bel Air. And we would go there on Sundays, and it was always this trek to go to like the big mansion where we pretended we were a happy family and sucked up to the boss. And we did that for years. And then we'd come home and the fighting would start again. And so I really liked it over at the boss's house. It was like, they played Scrabble. Everybody got along. And then we'd come home and it was like, you know, a war zone. But the idea was that eventually my dad was going to get the big break. He was going to get this promotion. So our whole family was like in suspended animation. We were waiting for him to get this news. And that was going to be the magic bullet, the magic pill that made all the strife worthwhile. He came home one night and announced that not only was he not getting that promotion, but that he had been fired from his job for drinking. And I just remember seeing him completely defeated. By the way, I'm past fourth grade now, so everything's good. And then my mom said to him, I did it backwards. My mom said that she was divorcing him. And he said, by the way, I also got fired today. So I saw my dad take a terrible hit, and our family take a terrible hit. Meanwhile, we were doing the alcoholic family thing of like keeping up appearances to the outside. It was so funny because everyone was at each other's throats inside the house. We had a couple of social workers that lived next door. You don't want social workers next door if you're an alcoholic family. And they were very nice. No, they really were. But they would come to me. They'd say, they'd hear the houses are close together. They'd hear the fighting going on. And then they'd see me. I'd go over there and play with their kids. And they'd say, is everything okay at home, Mike? You know, I'd say, well, sure, everything's okay. And then I'd go home and say, Mom, Mrs. B said that she asked me if everything was okay. Mom was incensed. How dare she cast aspersions about our happy family, you know? So it's just a lot of mixed messages. I excelled at school. It was where I really did well. My parents did divorce. We moved to Sherman Oaks with my mom. My sister moved up to Berkeley, where acting the way she did was very common and normal, and she fit right in the 60s. And we carried on. And I went to high school, and I switched from this little tiny private school, this little tiny, tiny school where I was kind of a big, I was a big deal at that school. Because I was always getting the straight A's and getting in the plays and doing all that. So this big high school that was like 3,000 people in Van Nuys, and I was like lost. But a counselor said, asked me something about what I liked. I said, I like to go to plays. So he put me in drama, and that was that. And that turned out to kind of be a saving grace. At that point too, I'm not even gonna go into that story, but at that point too, sexuality was coming to the fore, and I realized that I was gay. It actually happened in ninth grade when I was still at the old school. And, you know, between my religion and the society I lived in, and my desire to be so perfect so I could heal his family once and for all, that was like the final insult from God. I was so mad. I was so mad. And I thought, God, I'm going to have to think some really, really good thoughts now to heal this. And sure enough, there were articles in our religious literature that would say, this can be healed. You know, that was a pathology in the 60s. And so I had it. I just say that to kind of complete the picture that with alcoholism and my Al-Anon response to it, all I could think to do was to try to do the right thing. But I could never seem to do the right thing. And I could never think the right thought. Anyway, so that's the bad old days. After college, I moved to New York. I did what they call a geographic, and there were no alcoholics around me. Well, it was New York, but the ones I knew, I left behind, and I was striking out on my own, and it was great. And I took to New York like a fish to water. It was just great. It was like, ah, now I get it. Now I get it. Urban life. This is it, and it was all good. And only looking back do I see that the people I started to get romantically involved with, they are all drinkers. It's uncanny. It's uncanny. But you know, every alcoholic in my life, it has never been the drinking that's bothered me. It's been, in the case of my dad, it was the fighting. In the case of this one individual, it was the infidelity. And there was always, I was an usher at the Music Center before I went to New York, and that was my first kind of like romance with a guy who was a footman at the Music Center. He was also involved with this older guy who was worked at the box office at the Music Center. But he wanted to have a relationship with me that the older guy knew about, and they were both okay with it. And I said, okay. And I said, okay. And there was a pattern. The only reason I mention it is there was a pattern there that I didn't realize was happening, which was taking what you could call crumbs and trying to make a relationship out of them. I just took whatever I could get. And I was so grateful for whatever I could get that I never questioned like the rightness of it. I don't mean right in a moral sense. That just doesn't interest me anymore. But I mean right in the sense of what's nourishing, you know, what's spiritually nourishing. And that was never a concern for me, never, never. Even when I was a religious zealot as a kid, I was mad at my parents for not towing the line, you know? You guys gotta stop drinking and smoking, you know? And I became like the religious zealot. I was the one with the magazines, waving the books around and all of that. And, I just thought I better take what I can get. And this made sense to me. I didn't feel like I was compromising or losing out or short-changing myself. I just thought, this is the best I'll get, so I'll do it. And again, just like with my home life, it wasn't all bleak. It wasn't all bleak at all. There was a lot of fun stuff. There was a lot of great stuff. And I led a very fun life in New York, and I did some shows and got into theater, and I met a power greater than myself, who I choose to call Stephen Sondheim. So it wasn't all bleak. But I'm just sharing with you some of the more of the underbelly side, because I think you'll get it. And I'm grateful to be with you just to share experience, to make it a little less powerful for all of us. And I know that what I've done won't match up with what you've done, but I think there's a common experience underneath the outward behaviors of hopelessness, and take what you can get. And that's all for you. That's all for you. That's enough. You know, and that kind of limiting spiritual emptiness. I rejected my religion, of course, because I became like a militant homosexual, which was good for me. It was good for me. And I left all of that religious stuff behind, and I led a nice life in New York. I did some theater. I had a lot of fun, went on some tours and sang and danced and I had a club act, a cabaret act I used to do. I used to do one called So Tasty Too, and all the songs were about food. It was really fun. And I would do these like little cabaret shows at clubs in the village. It was fun. So it wasn't all bleak, but these drinkers, only looking back do I see there were the drinkers. So I lived in the heart of Greenwich Village over a piano bar. Talk about living around alcoholics. I lived over a piano bar in a tiny apartment, three rooms, but the three rooms were like from here maybe to the edge of that table that's close to me. I mean, and there was no outside window. There were windows onto the air shaft. And when you opened the window, all you got was these wafts of char grill smoke coming up from the restaurant downstairs, the bar called the Red Lion. And I lived over drunk people for 8 years singing, if I hear this song ever again, I might go postal. They were singing Bye Bye Blackbird. Bye Bye Blackbird. I don't know what it is about drinking in Bye Bye Blackbird, but they love it. Are there any alcoholics here? Have you ever sung Bye Bye Blackbird? I just want to know, what is it with that song? It was crazy. And the building was owned by a mafia guy, and I was so clueless. I was so clueless that I was complaining to the owner about this noise from the bar downstairs. Well, it was probably a front of some kind, and I had no business getting my attitude up with my mafia landlord. I remember asking the people next door, they had lived there for like 20 years, and I didn't know how they could have done it. I knocked on their door, I said, Lori, can you join me? I'm gonna complain to Mr. Longo about the noise. And she just goes, we can't help you. I'm sure she was just seeing me, you know, floating in the Hudson River at that point. Because, you know, no one does self-righteousness like an Al-Anon. You gotta give us credit for that. We're good at that one. We're good at that one. And there's no feeling I used to like, and sometimes when I slip, still like more than feeling indignant and wronged and righteously angry about how I've been treated or what I've had to put up with. Oh, it's like mother's milk to me. Isn't that sad? But there's a good part of this story, it's coming. So around 1992 or 3, I was in a bar. I was doing stand-up comedy, then I'd go to this bar afterwards and drink and cruise. And I met a really great person. I'll just call him Mr. T. I'll call him Senor T because he was from Cuba. And Senor T was great. He had long hair, like he looked like he came out of like a Sheriff of Cochise. What's that? Cochise? Boy, those old movies. Anyway, he looked like an American Indian from a movie. And he was so exotic looking. And we got to talking, and his then lover had died, and he had lost his job, and he was about to end up on the street. And I thought, wow, I've hit the jackpot. I've hit the jackpot. And we're at a restaurant having dinner, and I said, these words came out of my mouth. I swear I didn't premeditate them. And even as they were coming out, I thought, what the are you doing? I said, well, do you want to come and live with me? And his eyes just lit up, you know. And I maybe never healed my family, but I was going to heal him. I was certainly going to heal him of homelessness and maybe even of the drinking. So it was great. It was horrible and it was great. You know what I'm talking about. Like, you know you're doing your disease and you know it's bad, but there's something appealing about it. And we lived together, and you know what? We had a good several good years together. And then I wanted to kick him out. Because he wasn't earning enough. That was my thing. Again, the drinking didn't bother me. For him, it was the earning. And I had my, you know, Lois Wilson throwing the shoe at Bill? That's a pivotal moment in Al-Anon lore, if you're a newcomer. And that was when, if I'm telling it right, you guys know better than I, that she realized she needed help. So my shoe moment was when I went down the street to the Petco to buy this little bag of Yukonuba for like $8. And I became incensed that I was paying for the dog food instead of him. Again, the drinking didn't bother me. The money did in this case. Also, I had been reading a book by a doctor named Ron Rudin called The Craving Brain. And in the book, Ron Rudin said that one reason that AA is so successful is that the sense of safety that people have in the fellowship actually helps rebalance the serotonin and dopamine levels in the brain. I was reading that book because I was going to heal Senor T of his alcoholism, I was going to heal him of his addiction, of course, because I was so powerful. But that was the pivotal moment, and I said, shoot, I'm going to Al-Anon. I said, the worst thing that can happen is I'll get my serotonin rebalanced, you know? So I might as well give it a try, you know? I certainly don't need it. Now, almost everyone I hear that comes to Al-Anon, my first sponsors used to say, none of us comes into the rooms of Al-Anon on the wings of victory. I did. I came in on the wings of victory. I was mad, but I had it all together. And I walked into my first meeting, and I saw that easel. It was an easel, just like that. And I thought, well, what are those doing here? And I thought, maybe I walked into the wrong room, because it says 12 steps. And so I sat, you know, you can't talk, you can't crosstalk, you can't do much except sit. So I sat, feeling ignored, and, you know, I wanted my time to, you know, vent. And because I thought Al-Anon was going to give me a place to vent. I thought the reason I was coming was that I was going to commiserate with you about how bad I had it. And I would return the favor to you. And we would acknowledge to each other how bad we had it. And how miserable this unmanageable person was making our lives, but through no fault of our own. That's what I was expecting. I saw those steps and I thought, well, they can't be for us because we're the sane ones. I really thought that. They can't be for us because we're the sane ones. So I guess they put them up there so that we can get an idea what the poor alcoholics have to go through when they go to AA, you know? So I thought, that's really nice. It's like compassion, you know? I'm so glad I don't have to do that. But I feel bad for those alcoholics, but I admire them. You know, they're working those steps. Good, bully, you know? So it wasn't long before the thing that really bugged me about meetings when I first came, no crosstalk. That drove me insane, because I had read a lot of self-help books. I mean, a lot, including the one that got me in about the dopamine and serotonin. So I was always up on the latest self-help therapy. And I would hear these people share, And all I could think of was, oh, I've got to tell her about this book I know. Oh, he would do well with this book. I knew what would help everybody. But you guys told me I couldn't talk. I couldn't crosstalk. I could do it afterwards, but I couldn't talk. I didn't know why you were telling me that at the time. I totally get it now, but I didn't know why. But it didn't matter. I didn't need to know why. You were healing me with that simple principle of no crosstalk. That's profound. We're very lucky, I think, to be in a fellowship that follows that structure. So yes, I discovered that I would have to do the steps myself, or I would have the opportunity to. I came into that first meeting on West 99th Street and Broadway, and I was in a fog for at least the first 6 months, but they had couches around the edges of the room, and they were so comfortable. And I just loved coming and sitting in the couch, and I really didn't get a lot of what I was hearing, because I was hearing things that didn't make sense to my Al-Anon brain at all. And the first thing I remember hearing, there was one woman who, she was a double winner, she was fabulous, named Rosemary. And she was kind of like the oracle. She would just spout these things out. And she said, things you've probably heard. She said, what someone else thinks of me is none of my business. I thought, well, that is crazy. But there's something appealing about it, you know? So that's it. That was my... I feel that as low as the disease knocks us down, there's at least a little cell that made it and that is still intact and that still has a connection with a power greater than itself. And I felt like that was my little God molecule. I didn't understand what she was saying, but I liked the sound of it. I said, if it were true, it would be really cool. I know it's not, but wow, imagine if it were, it would change my whole focus. Because all I thought I was supposed to be doing was control your opinion of me. I really did think that's what my purpose was. Or then she'd say, well, Al-Anon is really a program of self-acceptance, not self-improvement. I said, well, that's not good at all. Because I have a whole library full of self-improvement books, and I've invested a lot of time and energy and hours on couches in therapist's office trying to improve. Self-acceptance. And then that little molecule in me said, something's nice about that. One time she said, there was a meeting, they were talking about concepts of a higher power. And she goes, you know, here's what it is for me. As far as I'm concerned today, God is just the way things are. And I thought, wow, that's wrong too. But I it's totally wrong. Because I grew up with the ideal. I had to reach the spiritual level. I had to reach this level of understanding that would transport me into a new reality where everything was beautiful. But whatever it was, I had to get out of where I was right now. That's what I had to do. My whole life was about trying to get out of the present moment. But she said that, and I thought, God, that sounds really cool. Wrong, but cool. I'll go with it. I mean, I didn't even go with it, but I just tucked it away. So all these beautiful things were happening, and my Al-Anon group there was healing me. All this healing that I wanted to do to my family, to them is really the way to say it. I wanted to do healing to them. And I failed and I blamed myself. And I came into Al-Anon and you guys started healing me right away. Healing me. Healing me. I wasn't supposed to be the one that needed healing. I was the one that had it all together. You know, when I was a kid, at one point, my family had like a rare, rare moment of sanity. And they decided that we should go to family therapy. You know, in the 1960s, that was pretty radical. And I was just thinking, on Mad Men, they do that. But which was very much like my family. So they went to family therapy. My dad went, my mom went, my sister went, and they left me home. And they said, my mom said she left me home because I was not troubled. I was not having a problem. Because my sister was, it's so easy to identify the addict as the problem. because let's face it, they're a little more colorful than we are. You know, let's just say it. That's why we get attracted. That colorfulness is wonderful. That's why I went to Senior T, for sure. He was very colorful. He was a great guy. Oh yeah. So I'm in Al-Anon and I'm living with Mr. T, Senior T, and then we would go out with friends. We go to like a Mexican restaurant and order a pitcher of margaritas for Senior T. The pitcher was for him. And my friends were like, Mike, I think he has a drinking problem. What's he doing? He's drinking all the margarita in the whole pitcher. What is that? Stop that. Make him stop. Or another time, we went to a dinner party at my friend Linda and Bud's house, and we came home, and the next morning, Linda calls, she goes, Mike, Senior T stole a bottle of our best red wine. But I was in Al-Anon only a short time, but you'd given me already I soaked something up, because I thought, well, that may be. And if you have a problem with it, you need to talk to Senior T. I'm not his babysitter, you know? Victory! So, and same at the restaurant with the margaritas. It was like, Alfred, I remember Alfred. I said, Alfred, I'm okay with it. You know, it's a little bit expensive. My thing is always money. I didn't care about the drinking, but the money. God, I don't know how I got that one. Irish or something. So I was learning these things in spite of myself. That's my point. That in Al-Anon, I was going, and even before I got into the hardcore step work and sponsorship, getting a sponsor. Oh God, that was so beautiful. And but I was soaking it up somehow without trying to. That's how easy you all made it for me. That's why I'm grateful to you. I don't have to achieve anything. And I never knew that before. And I don't have to bring anything about. And I never knew that before either. I don't need to do anything. I have this moment, and I have the option in each moment whether to occupy this moment and know some sense of peace, or to go crazy in my head and go on a spin of self-abuse or judgment of someone else or worry. I was diagnosed with something called body dysmorphic disorder recently, and it's an outside issue for sure. However, it's not, because it's really kind of tied to obsessive compulsive behavior. And it's just a theory, so I'm just, you know, shooting into the dark. But to me, I draw a line to the alcoholic situation, because there was so much that needed to be controlled and wasn't being controlled. And I thought if I could just get a handle on everything, everything would be okay. But I came into Al-Anon and you said, it's self-acceptance, not self-improvement. And you helped me get better. The steps have been amazing for me. Sponsorship has been amazing. I've had only two sponsors in my whole time, and they've both been so patient. My first coffee shop sit down with my first sponsor in New York. Oh yeah, so I had this body dysmorphic disorder. Thank you. The Greek diners in New York City have a lot of mirrors all over the place. A lot of tacky murals and a lot of mirrors. And, well, they're not tacky, really. That's just me being judgmental. They're murals, three-dimensional murals, of like the Greek islands. So I'm sitting there with my new sponsor, who I just adore, and I see myself in the mirror, and I start sobbing. And he says, what's going on? And I said, well, I saw myself in the mirror, and it's so bad. It's so bad. And he was very compassionate, but he smiled, not in an uncaring way, in a really cool way. And I said, what? And he said, you're working step one. You're working step one. It's great. Mazel tov. He was Jewish. Mazel tov, my child. We always played the rabbi thing. And I just mentioned that the sponsorship has been great. My current sponsor is the most patient, compassionate, non-directive man I've ever met in my entire life. I had to arm wrestle him to force him, right? This is true. Not really arm wrestle, but practically. In his car, I said, Peter, I'm going to lead that big meeting. I think I should wear a tie. What do you think? Well, yeah, you could wear a tie. Do you think I should wear a tie? If I don't wear a tie, will they think I'm not respectful? Should I? Everyone seems to wear a tie. Well, all the men anyway, some of the women too. And it's like, I better wear a tie. He says, drives me nuts. I said, where's my black belt sponsor? You're supposed to say, wear a tie. He goes, okay, wear a tie. It was great. Wasn't that fun? That was really fun. And he said, you know, you're going to do what you want anyway. I got a good sponsor. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful. I needed to talk to you tonight. I really did. You've helped me more than you can know. And I just want to close by going back to that quote and say, you know, what Al-Anon's given me, that experience that the character of Edmund talks about in Long Day's Journey, the veil of things as they see, you know, we talk about false evidence appearing real as a definition for fear. The veil of things as they seem is drawn back by an unseen hand. And for a moment you see. And seeing the secret, you are the secret. For a moment, there is meaning. And I just put the period right there, because that's what you give me, an opportunity to experience moment by moment by moment. Thank you for giving meaning to my life. Appreciate it.